News and Talk Station.
7 minutes past 10 o'clock. Welcome to the second hour of the Eusebius Makhaza Show on Cape Talk and 702. With me, Gugs Mhlongo, in for Eusebius this morning and with you until midday today. Coming up a little bit later is our literature corner, and we'll be looking at an interesting book called The God Who Made Mistakes by Eko Dakar, which is an interesting story based in suburban Johannesburg that looks at the issues around sexuality. And we're going to be speaking to Eko about that. And then also, it being National Breastfeeding Week, we'll be looking at how to help improve the health of babies around the world, particularly through encouraging breastfeeding, and also to look at why South Africa's rates of exclusive breastfeeding are so low, some of the lowest in the world. And we'll have that conversation just after 11:30. But right now, joined in studio by three guests on the line, we have clinical psychologist Khosi Giani. Also joined by actor, you know this voice. He's probably been, you know, one of your favorite characters. Selo Makega Ngube joining us today. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Hello.
Good morning to the listeners.
We also have Deputy Editor of the Huffington Post South Africa, Noxolo Mafu, in studio.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us today. And hello to you as well, Khosi, on the line.
Thank you.
Hello. So quite a big topic, or a sensitive topic, that we're looking at today. And it's about, are we willing or are we unwilling to hold really talented, perhaps famous men for accountable if they are found to have been or accused of being violent? And often what comes up is the idea of separating the man from the art, or separate, you know, that they're two different people. And Silo, I mean, you've been in the arts for a very long time. You also speak out quite often. You have an organization that talks about violence and how we should deal with violence in society.
Right.
But part of my thinking is, so of course in the arts or in the entertainment space, there would be violence as well, because South Africa is a particularly violent country. So the arts aren't unique in that way, mm-hmm. with violence in schools, violence at universities, violence in the workplace, violence in public. So, but there seems to be a reluctance to discuss it in reference to the arts. Is that a correct assessment?
I don't subscribe to that, because in 1998, mm-hmm. I workshopped a piece with four young men in Alexander mm-hmm. that dealt with domestic violence mm-hmm. from the male perspective. Mm-hmm. I mean, these guys were working with ADAPT. It's an organization that deals with domestic violence mm. in Alexander. And they had a young men's program. And I learned that there were these guys who wanted to do a play. And the subject has been in my life and in my head, I think, from the age of 24. That is like back then in 1984.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when I heard that there was these young men who wanted to do a play, I said, oopsie, I'm going for it, because I've always wanted to interrogate the subject.
Mm.
So I wouldn't say the arts don't really connect with the, or what don't, doesn't want to deal with the subject,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I personally have, you know, went out of my way to go and do it. And we did a 25-minute, which I've just revived recently when I launched the Afri Men Rising campaign mm-hmm. at TUT,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is aimed at, you know, gender sensitizing young men,
mm-hmm.
you know, in at the tertiary institutes, because those are the future men. And yeah, it was a 25-minute. And then later on, I mean, in 2000, I wrote a fully fledged play, which I produced at the Market Theatre in 2000.
Mm.
And what we used to do, like every Saturday, not every Sunday, because on Sundays we have a matinee, we would have panel discussions after the show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. So it is a subject that I've always been, it has been very close to my heart for years.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Knox, from a reporting perspective, very often there are criticisms of how we, and I say we because I'm also in the media space,
absolutely.
About how we deal with issues of violence, particularly as far as they might involve someone who's well-regarded, someone who's famous, someone who has power, be it a politician, an artist, a singer, whatever, about, you know, we could do a lot better. And in your view, what are some of, you know, the ways in which we could improve reporting around domestic violence?
Sure. I mean, I have to agree with a lot of public opinion in that I do think that when it comes to an artist or a revered personality, it becomes very hard to see them as a person who is flawed and has also completely violated, whether it's a woman's body or a man's body, or done something that is against the law. I do think, though, in the way we report it, rather than just giving us, you know, the headline that so-and-so has abused their partner, we need to follow these cases as attentively as we do your Reeva Steenkamp's. Well, I mean, that's an example of violence, but all the other kind of criminal cases that get a lot of resource in the newsroom allocated to them. I find a lot of the time that when it comes to these situations, it's just kind of the first headline, the thing that will get you that clickbait. And then after that, there's no real interrogation to the people affected and really breaking down the issues to it. So I think a lot of the time we don't spend time unpacking the issue at large.
The point about unpacking it also would require us to then place violence in the context of the rest of society, where we see violence in different places. So in the home, in the workplace, in public in some instances. So it would require us to make it, not normalize it, but put it in that space to say it happens in the context of it happening, you know, everywhere else.
Yeah. And, you know, it's I mean, obviously people are, you know, you have to protect people. And I mean, there's language also in our discipline, you know, things of being the accused. We can't name someone who's accused before they've appeared in court, all of which I think is a constitutional right. And I think we do have to protect that. Mm-hmm. But of a lot of that practice, I think, makes it very hard for us to deal with what the issue is, as you're mentioning, the violence that is at issue. And particularly, I don't understand sometimes how, even in responses to, let's say, these articles about a star who may have abused a partner, that a lot of the audience sometimes engagement is that we're threatening their livelihoods. How mm-hmm. could you threaten this personality? Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting in that also, as the people who receive the content, they're not willing sometimes, and I can't say this is all the time, aren't willing to see that personality in a particular space where they have to be put in front of the law just like any other Tabo, John or Mary.
Kosi, just to come to you about the psychology often involved in when we speak about violence, but particularly intimate partner violence, very often I think there might be a reluctance to speak about it because there's a fear of, you know, someone might not believe you, or there might be backlash, particularly if the person you is involved might have, you know, a bigger stature, a bigger platform than you. So the idea of fear and how we deal or don't deal with violence, how big of a factor does that still play?
I think, hi, Cooks. I think it certainly does. And I think what the two speakers before me have alluded to speaks to exactly the dynamics at play there. And I think one of the big things, or one of the big challenges that's already been alluded to, is this interpermeation or the blending or the blurring of boundaries between the craft or the work self, you know, and the personal self. And that may be a challenge for the person themselves, the celebrity that we're talking about, the male celebrity that we're talking about, but also for the broader society. And the tendency to aggrandize and put, by virtue of them being so out there in the public space, putting them on a pedestal that psychologically for them as well as for society in you know, at large, has a sense that they are larger than life. They are exempted from the normal rules of society. They are above the law on some, and they have leeway. So you know, the whole notion of some are more equal than others, applying there, and it creates that dissonance for all of us. And I think that's one thing that we need to break from and recognize that. I think Usilla started with the fact that, you know, today's celebrity is yesterday's child, and we need to revisit our sense of self as a society, and how we articulate who we are, and therefore what we allow and not allow. And obviously, you know, by the time people become celebrities, they have been socialized, firstly at home, in their community. And the media itself is littered with socialization messages that are both explicit and implicit. And, you know, around gender, gender identity, gender roles, and in terms of relationships between males and females. And by the time that people get to that stage, the larger stage, you know, there's been what one may say are very contradictory messages or plurality of messaging. And it becomes very difficult to navigate that road for many people.
17 minutes after 10 o'clock, having a discussion about, is society willing to hold some of its heroes to account if your hero be a sports star, an actor, a singer, a politician, and in some instances, normal people who are fathers, business owners, church leaders, accountable if they are found to have behaved in a manner that is violent, either towards someone in their family, someone in their immediate community? Or do we make exceptions for people that we are fond of, or people we revere, or people we are inspired by, and we separate them from their actions? We take your calls on 021-446-0567 and 011-883-0702. You can also send us your SMSs on 31567 and 31702.
Call us on 011-883-0702 or 021-446-0567.
21 minutes after 10 o'clock, you're still on Cape Talk and 702 on the Sibus Makhaza Show. Joined in studio by a deputy editor for the Huffington Post South Africa, Nokolo Mafu. Also joined in studio by veteran actor and director, Selomake Gangube. On the line, we have psychologist Kosi Giane to speak about the culture of perhaps giving people who are revered, who are powerful, who are important in some ways, a pass on violence, particularly violence against women and children, and taking your calls on whether perhaps you've had to deal with someone you've revered or loved, and it turned out they weren't quite as perfect as you thought they were, and how you dealt with that. And you can call us on 021-446-0567 and 011-883-0702. Before the break, Silo, Kosi was speaking about the issue of socialization, how ultimately, you know, children, boy children, girl children, become adults. And in many ways, society at all times is telling us how to treat each other, what is acceptable and what is correct. And one of the things you mentioned was the play you did, which you're doing again with the young men. And having to, I guess, teach sensitivity or sensitivity to gender issues like violence. And when we start doing that, is there a willingness to challenge what's often, you know, normal or stuff that's become culture to say, well, maybe we should relook at this, or these are the issues here. Yeah. Is there a willingness to do that?
I think now there is. You know, I mean, when I started doing coming, and especially because, I mean, once I did it at the market, then it was open to public scrutiny. And I remember one journalist, I mean, reacted very strongly to it, and he said that I was portraying black men as brutes. You know, and but he later changed his tune in, you know, after a couple of years. And really, after a couple of years, he changed his tune because he realized that what I had depicted was not really just trying to create black men as brutes. You know, and I think I was clear about one thing, that I wasn't going to do this play and create excuses for men. You know, and it would have been easy to go that route, you know. But I think I went with an eye that looked deep into what led us to being the way we are, and that is the socialization. And even for me to, you know, to get into that space, and like I said, I mean, I was 24 when I think my abusive nature actually, you know, manifested itself at that time. And I think I was just fortunate by the fact that I had this little voice inside of my head, you know, and after I did it once, I was like, what are you doing? You know, I did it the second time. I said, what are you doing? And I remember even saying to my girlfriend then, I said, I don't understand this. How could I say that I love you And then the next moment I do this, you know. And I think it took me on a very interesting journey, because after that, then I started looking into myself, analyzing, you know, and why was I getting into those spaces or in that space? And I realized my insecurities. I realized as well, I mean, I do have a bit of a stutter, and it gets worse, you know, when I'm agitated, you know. And that for me, that is why I say for me, then the journey started then. I mean, in 84, when it was not fashionable to what to do what I later learned to be timeout, I practiced that, you know. So, and from me, the, from there on, it has been a thing that I just observed, you know, from my society. And one has got to remember again that growing up in the township, and I remember as a young man, you know, you've been sent to go buy bread or buy something at the shop. You know, you're coming around the corner, and at that time, maybe you're 10, 11, and you're coming across a couple, you know, young, a teenage couple on the corner. And as you pass, you just hear, whoop! A smack, you know. So you grow up with this thing happening, you know.
Seemingly normal.
Normal.
But completely abnormal. It shouldn't
exactly.
happen.
Exactly. You know what I mean? And that's what influences you. And I think I started, you know, interrogating all those little things. When was it? On Monday. On Monday, I had a discussion with the students at the SABC. And, I was there to talk about the industry. But, you know, the conversation found its way to dealing with, you know, men's issues. And here's another thing. As people, we've spent the first 12 years of our lives being prepared to fit into the economic cog machine.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody teaches us how to be human beings. You know, and it is even worse now with, you know, the way things are, single parenting and whatever. And until we actually make it a duty that when we raise children, they're actually being taught how to be men, and maybe women also how to be women. But also, I don't mean teaching women how to be women in the whatever traditional and contextual sense, but also to understand their own makeup. One of the things that I do is actually explain to, when I'm talking to young men, just to understand the male psyche, you know. And I'm taking lessons from myself and from the community at large.
Knox, so when we, and you touched on it earlier, so the issue of being able to articulate some of the issues around violence. And I often wonder if when people go into newsrooms, if you're aware of the biases that you might be bringing to your work. So say you are someone who believes that violence is normal, or you don't even think of it as violence because there's so much that's normal behavior,
absolutely,
which actually is violence. And we socialize boy children and girl children into accepting certain behaviors as violence. So I often wonder when we then attempt to explain these things, do we have the language? Do we know that we come to our work with those biases or believing certain things are normal?
I think it's interesting, Gugu. I think, you know, we, particularly, for instance, at HAF, we've worked very hard to deal with these issues holistically, and not just if it's an entertainment story, if, let's say, it's your favorite singer who's done this. We put the whole team on a story, particularly because of that. You can be put on a story and completely not see your blind spots purely, let's say, because you've been normalized to think that some kind of violence is okay. And by making it a space where we, as a team, work on how do we report on the story? What are the gaps that are missing in the dialogue, particularly in the media? That, I think, is a way in which we try penetrate that issue. And so you make sure that no one person's issues are pouring or are being, you know, dealt with in this one story. I do think, though, that we do have a lot of work to do in terms of doing that and addressing even the psyche of the people who are reporting on a lot of the content. It's, you know, we obviously live in a very fast-paced situation. We have to turn over content quite quickly. But it really is important to see what it is that people are coming to the office with. And the newsroom has to be one where we interrogate these issues, not just with the desk, let's say, where this thing, the beat, whether it's politics or something that it's belongs to, but the newsroom at large. I think a lot of that does inform those blind spots so that we think of every kind of reader. We think of every kind of South African who could maybe say that this is normal. And how do we explain to them that what you saw your teenage neighbors doing when they were smacking each other, let's say, around the corner, is not normal? Yes, you are used to it. You can stomach it. But we have to interrogate that that is not a way in which we can't normalize that behavior.
It's just gone 10:30, and we continue with this conversation. And of course, your calls on 021-446-0567 and 011-883-0702 are still joined in studio by Knox and Silo. Kosigiani is on the line to us.
Call us on 011-883-0702 or 021-446-0567.
26 minutes before 11 o'clock. You're still on the Cebus Makhaza Show on Cape Talk and 702. And we're still taking your calls on the willingness, the ability of society to hold people they hold in high regard, their heroes, people who may have had fantastic careers, to account if it comes out that they've been violent in some way. And we're taking your calls on 021-446-0567 and 011-883-0702. We also take your SMSs on 31702 and 31567. Kosi, there's an SMS here, I'll give an opportunity for all three of you to respond to it, but the SMS says, Googs, I'm a woman, and with respect, many girls and women who pursue men who are abusive and bad boys, they knowingly pursue them, date them, have children with them, all while knowing they're open to abuse and exposing their kids to that too. The message also goes on to say that women need to stop being enablers to those atrocities. So the idea of perhaps knowing or in some way sensing that someone is abusive, or the idea of the bad boy, that comes up quite often, that if there is abuse that comes to light, people say, well, you know, you should have known, or it was always going to happen. Why couldn't you foresee it? And the kind of impact that has on, you know, people's ability to speak out about abuse, but also the willingness for society to then say this thing has happened and it's a problem. So the idea of the bad boy, what kind of impact does that have?
You know, the notion of the bad boy is around the rewarding of negative behavior, to the point where we ourselves are not able to deal with it effectively because of the contradiction messaging that we have created in the collective mind, in terms of saying this is wrong, but when it is done by so and so, we accept it. And the bad boy in terms of the context of this discussion right now is very often mixed with the sense of materiality. And there is often a materiality that allows this sense of bad boy to operate with the mindset that they are above. And not only they themselves, but also the women that then want to be associated with this, because it's this, that they will be the bad boy, beat you up, however, they will reward you for that. And often the messaging in society is that men are going to abuse you anyway, so at least this one will compensate in some way with the materiality. And the beat up becomes a way through which, they can guilt trip the person into then compensatory materialistic behavior. And it becomes a vicious circle for both the woman and the man involved in it. And it is also part of the bigger contradictory messages that we get in the media, in the roles that we assign women to, the roles of subservience that we assign women to, but also the roles of saying women have a choice, you know. And then when they do make those sorts of choices, we as a society are thrust into a dilemma about saying, are we then going to want to circumscribe their freedom and put them in roles of deprivation, or do we then allow them to say women are free to make choices, and if this is the choice that they make, then so be it. We as a society can stand there with our arms in the air.
So the idea of the bad boy, Silo, is there such a thing, or do we create it and deploy it when we need it? The idea that someone, or you should know that someone is going to be this way.
That's a very difficult one. But one thing that I would like to appreciate about the SMS, the person who wrote the SMS, it's I think it's the honesty that she brings across.
Mm.
And it just reminded me, in fact, you know, there's a quote by Bell Hooks. Bell Hooks is an African-American feminist.
Mm.
And there is a book of hers called Sisters of the Yam.
Mm.
And it's a book about, basically it's about self-recovery. And there's this quote that I liked, and I actually used it in my speech last week Friday when I was launching AfriMen Rising. And she says, commitment to truth-telling is thus the first step in any process of self-recovery. A culture of domination is necessarily a culture where lying is an acceptable social norm.
Mm.
And I think that is I think for me is that until we come to that space where we are really, really honest,
mm.
and both genders, you know, that men are like this and women are like this. And I think what I would still, you know, and this is a conversation that I would really like to have with Kosi there. And I think about the psychological makeup of the different genders, you know. Mm. And I think until we come to that space where we truly analyze each other's makeup and understand them, you know, then we will actually begin to know how we can begin to start having a dialogue amongst each other.
Mm.
And the whole thing of the bad boy, and the bad boy is in many facets.
Mm.
You know what I mean? It is not the bad boy as in the criminal, or the bad boy as in whatever, because the bad boy also comes with a man of high social status.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know, and the bad in them actually differs, you know, in degrees. And the thing is, what is it that makes women get attracted to power?
Mm.
Because in many instances, I think for me, that is what is at play.
Mm.
You know, because the bad boy has power. And whichever way that power comes, whether it comes through a football star, whether it comes through a person with high intellect, you know, in the university.
Or talent.
Sings well, or speaks well, or writes well. You know, it's all those things. And you find that at best, women are attracted to that.
So mm. the idea of, I guess, how we frame as well, Nokolo, mm-hmm. and the idea, I guess, of the bad boy,
mm.
where, so if something comes out and then it becomes about, well, you know, you should have known about Googs, or you should have, or, you know, Googs has this history. That often comes up in reporting mm. around issues of violence as well.
Mm.
And what most survivors will tell you as well is very often people who end up being the abusers, you know, weren't a bad boy,
mm.
or they weren't what society thinks, you know, people are when they're about to be abusive towards you. But that idea comes up quite often in our reporting.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I mean, of course, you know, in the style of writing, you have to contextualize these things that, you know, they've had a pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that you can only really explain away an episode of violence by saying, well, you know, you should have known he did A, B, and C, and D. And I think a lot of that starts to normalize violence and only, you know, adds more power, you know, in the discussion we were just having previously. I think a lot of that in normalizing and glamorizing violence, and that also goes back to, you know, how we depict violence in our music videos, that only gives more status to the bad boy, you know, mm-hmm. and that concept of the bad boy. And I completely agree. The bad boy, there are different facets of it and it looks different. But I do think when we report, I think there needs to be a very good way in which we look at how it is that this violence has manifested. The criminal record also, I think that context is important, but also I think by listing those things and reporting it in a way, well, it kind of puts it into a position of victim blaming, which is very, very often what we find in the way we report, in that, well, he had a history of this, she should have known. And a lot of the responses also, I think, which is more frightening, is that you'll find readers, subscribers to who, whatever it is, will be like, but you should have known he is that person. So I don't think, I think it's an institutional issue. We have to admit that. But also society accepts that also and doesn't call it out. And I think there needs to be a call and response between the media, between the people it's serving, so that we correct each other, because there are obvious biases that we have inherently that are bleeding into our institutions.
So in the same way that the media holds society to account, society should also then say, you know, here, this is how we could have done this better. Yeah. This is how we could have reported on this better.
Absolutely.
So almost that conversation where the media is constantly also learning and unlearning with society.
Yes. And I think that's, I mean, even just being a new publication, that's what you have to go in with, a position that we need to unlearn the mistakes. There are problems in the way that we've done things before. And in order to shift the conversation, in order to get into the deep tissue, the uncomfortable content, we have to listen to the people who consume and let them also tell us what they need to hear and how they need to understand their favorite celebrities or talents or politicians. And it is a difficult and sometimes awkward relationship and dialogue, but it is absolutely critical in order for us to get through and unravel these norms that we've created.
Mushere in Pretoria West, good morning.
Yes, good morning, I guess. Google society, sometimes we tend to, those who are, we celebrate, we tend to protect. I remember long time ago when there was some allegation of Michael Jackson and R. Kelly abusing the young ones. People, we tend to, we don't wait for the court to come out and pronounce someone not guilty. Once we love someone, the minute something is reported, we tend to defend. Remember also recently the Nigerian pastor who was, the church who upfront defending the past. And remember also the issue of Nicaragua, soul rest in peace. People, we tend to make a terrible mistake. Of course, and the media also. We tend to, those we love or those who are celebrated, we tend to put the spotlight on them. If you remember the issue of Garabo, when it turns out, people, men are trash. Sometimes we say, no, we shouldn't be generalizing. But with this one, people wanted to generalize. Then it becomes problematic when we want to deal with issues that are affecting us. Then you ask yourself question, when do we generalize and when do we not want to generalize? You remember during the issue of Rivers Dam Dam, next to the court where Oscar Pistorius' case was taking place, there was another case of which the media didn't say anything about it. We tend to be selective, and that it makes us difficult to deal with the issue of how do we condemn what is not good in the society. Not recently, Cyril Ramaphosa went to Rema Church, and people lost focus and said that, how can you go to the church? Zuma wasn't allowed. We tend to live what we're supposed to be, putting spotlight on and addressing the issue. At one point, when he went to church, he was talking about protecting women and children. Mm-hmm. But people said, no, Zuma was not allowed, now Ramaphosa. Then we lose focus. Christian Zuma, when he was accused, women came forward to protect before and waiting for the court to pronounce the man not guilty. We need to tackle the issues of women abuse and children abuse equally. And the media also must put spotlight. Number of practical examples that one can give. We're not dealing with the issues equally, and that makes us as a society to fail to deal with the issue decisively and may come up with solutions in order to address the issues that are affecting us as a society in general.
Thank you very much for your call. That's Mushere in Pretoria West. Miranda, good morning.
Yes, good morning, Guz. I think there's two things I wanted to bring into this conversation. One of them is that one of the biggest blocks on acting on suspicions of child or woman abuse, it's a tendency, which in fact all of us have, to divide the world into good people who generally do good things and bad people who do bad things. And so when we look at very powerful people and we can look at in our South Africa, in our own country, of the two big cases which we had women and men against child abuse have been involved in, and the two are obviously Bob Hewitt and Sidney Frankel, where for many years people were aware And a lot of people didn't act. Mm. So what we have here is we have, because they just couldn't believe that this person who was so powerful, charismatic, so charming, who gave to charities, who gave back to children in so many other ways, could also be abusing them. And then, of course, the people who may have been aware and didn't do anything then have a huge sense of betrayal, both to their community and to the children that they never spoke up to. Mm. And we must remember that these people who take the advantage of a power imbalance to sexually abuse a child or a woman also inspire feelings of powerlessness in adults who could have protected that child or that woman. And this sense of powerlessness may result from either emotional, being in the community and being within that family, or financial dependency on the person committing those acts. So, you know, and also people around these very powerful people who admire them and love them don't want to see that they have both the good and the bad in them.
Mm.
And I think this is something that we really have to understand how complex it is. And I have to tell you from just personal work with both of these cases that it divided many, many communities and also many families who, first of all, thought, you know, this may be a little bit of a witch hunt after these people. And it was only because so many children came forward and there were so many people who were prepared to say, I did see this, or I did feel this, or anonymously would call and say to us, please carry on with this investigation. This happened to my child, but they're in the midst of a divorce. They've been struggling with this issue or that. They can't come forward into a court of law and spend another 4 years mm-hmm. after 20 or 30 years of enduring the effects of sexual violence to them. So I think it's such an important topic that you have raised. I think so much more needs to be discussed on why, as human beings, we really find it difficult to talk out about people we trust in our communities who are either wealthy, popular, talented, or very generous, that they also have that other side to them. And that they aren't all good, and they're not also people who are all bad.
That it's often complicated.
Absolutely, and why we fail to protect the children, because normally, I mean, just in normal discussion, you or I and many other people would immediately say, if we heard this, we would immediately act on it.
Hmm.
But would you act on it if this person was your best friend who had come to your help, either financially or emotionally, if you had been, let's say, in a difficult circumstances, or, you know, maybe getting divorced or had an illness, and this person had been there for you.
Mm.
But somebody else had said to you, do you know that this person has been linked to this case? You would probably question that, because they had that relationship with you. And if they didn't, you would probably say, I couldn't believe that could have happened.
Hmm. Thank you very much for that call. That's Miranda raising, I think, what's another important issue of, and I think that's where often society finds itself, that complexity of, you know, here is someone who may have, I don't know, contributed to a culture, to sport, to politics, to whatever, but and great in that particular way, but also is also capable of, and it's the idea that in many ways we don't give some people the full range of the human emotions or the human capabilities.
Absolutely.
So you'll accept that Googs can be both great but also completely awful. But if it's someone you love, that might be a bit difficult.
You know, Googs, right. I mean, one of the things that we have to accept, you know, I mean, like me being Seloma Kekanube, someone would just look at me and think that I don't have any flaws.
Mm.
I do. Everybody has, you know. And I think for me, from where I'm coming from, is that I think as, you know, as a man, and the way I have viewed myself and viewed my environment. In fact, there's a lovely, lovely anecdote. that I heard one of the board members at ADAPT, you know, telling. And he talks about a carpenter who was working in his workshop, and he had a seven-year-old boy. And she kept on, you know, disturbing him. And in order to distract the boy, there was a map of the world on the wall. He took off the map, tore it into pieces, threw it on the floor, got a sellotape, and, you know, said, put this map together. Yeah. And, you know, that kept the boy, distracted the boy a bit, and he continued to work. But after a while, the boy came and he said, "Papa, I finished." Mm-hmm. Behind the map of the world was a man's head. And the moral of the story is that if a man can get his head together, the world would be a better place to be, you know. And I think for me, I have taken the responsibility, even in my, you know, everyday life. And from the journey that I took was to realize that in some very twisted way, I stand on a very fine line of making things better or worse. And somehow things can turn better depending on how I deal with the situation. And that is something that even, you know, my eldest son who passed on, we were starting to have that conversation and even beginning to shape him. And the whole thing of actually beginning to engage young men and young boys at this time, it is so crucial, you know, and knowing, and you know, one nice story was when we started having this conversation, because I dealt with this whole thing with him, with my son, about multiple relationships. And, you know, he listened. And but one time, I was in the UK and he was at DUT. And he calls me and said, "Hey, Moro, you know, Baba, this thing of yours of having one girlfriend doesn't work." You know, and I just thought, oh, my boy is seeing them from coming from all corners. But he mentioned something and I said, "But, I mean, what is the problem now?" And he said, "But what if she leaves me?" You know. And that made me realize that from where I was, when I was growing up, I kind of lived with that fear of what if she would leave me. And that made me to, you know, to cushion, to create cushions around myself by having multiple relationships. And I think that kind of conversation opened up things. And I had to be a father afterwards. And I said, "Well, are you going to let somebody's actions determine your own fate?" You know what I mean? I said, your problem would be what happens when she wants to come back. That she's left, she's gone. You have to move on. And I think it's one of those things that, you know, we got to have very serious and outright conversations.
Kosi, on Miranda's point about the complexity of often dealing with this issue and having to deal with, you know, the difficulty of someone you love who is great in some ways also being capable of, you know, harm or violence or doing stuff that you would find in anyone else that you didn't care for immediately. Abhorrent or unacceptable, and how we go about dealing with that complexity, because often I think people want it must be simple, otherwise it becomes very hard to deal with.
I wish there was a simple answer to this, but there isn't. And you know, not just Miranda but the caller before that spoke about this problem that I refer to as a halo effect. That just because a person, we've seen them, you know, sitting in our lounges, in our bedrooms, in our homes every day, as in the character that perhaps Silo plays every day, you know, we come to embrace that and make that everything about the person.
Yep.
And then we sanitize this person and we take away everything else that is human about them. Because, of course, we don't see them going to the bathroom and brushing teeth and doing things and, you know, having a bad day. They're always looking perfect on TV. People are brushed up. Everything, all the hair is in place and so on, which is not reality. And because of that, you know, it becomes so much harder, I think, psychologically, for us to undo that we are so on a daily basis fed with about the person. It leaves us very little room for flexibility to take in the shadow side of the person. And because they've been sanitized for so long. And also, there's also the phenomenon that perhaps we get so overwhelmed with negativity that whenever we find anything glorious, we want to hold on to it for dear life, not only in the other person, but in ourselves as well, that we start to look for the ideal self, our own ideal self in others, and in a similar way, struggle to integrate the two parts of not only the person, but of ourselves as well.
Mm.
And it becomes that vicious circle of when do we draw the line for ourselves and where do we draw the line
for
the other person as well.
Mm. Thank you very much, Khosi. That's Khosi Giane, clinical psychologist, joining us on the line. Silla and Knox, thank you to you for coming into studio and your contribution to this conversation.
Thank you so much for having us.